Okay, hello to everybody. I apologize for the delay. We're getting off to a 40-minute late start. We will be taking up the actual questions that we posted in the Jewish Times this past week. And that is on the beginning passages of Parshas Vayeshanan. And I'll read them to you. Not actually at the beginning, it's towards the beginning. It's chapter 4, and we're taking up, I believe we said, verses 9 through 16 or so. Okay. And again, we'll just do a brief audio check. Once you hear the audio streaming, just type audio okay on stream to confirm that you're picking up the stream properly. And again, this is Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 9 through 16. Hey Joshua, thanks for the audio confirmation. And unfortunately, sometimes, although we're broadcasting okay, sometimes people aren't receiving the broadcast properly. There's not much we can do about that, other than just advise them, check the speaker connections and so on. Okay, so the question was, well, what were the fundamentals that were being discussed? And I put the questions to you, so why don't we start by just reading over the verses. This way, if somebody's listening to this as an audio class, you'll understand what we're trying to answer. So it says, again, in this area, Deuteronomy 4 and 9, that Moses is now addressing the people, reminding them how about the event of Sinai. And he says, however, guard yourself and guard your souls greatly, exceedingly, lest you forget the matters which your eyes saw, and lest you remove from your hearts all the days of your lives, meaning this event of Sinai. And then he also says, you should make these known, this matter known to your children and to your grandchildren. The day which you stood before God, your God, in Horeb, which is synonymous with Sinai, when God spoke to me and told me that I should assemble the people, and God said, quote, and I will make them hear my words, that they should learn to fear me all the days that they are alive on the earth, and also their children they should teach, end quote. And then Moses continues, and again, Moses is reminding them of what took place 40 years earlier. And he says, now, this is 4:11, and you drew close and you stood under the mountain, and the mountain was burning with fire to the heart of the heavens. There was darkness, thick darkness, and cloud. And God spoke to you from the midst of the fire, the sound of words you heard, but a form you did not see, only a sound. All right, very interesting. And God told to you his treaty that he made, that he commanded you to do these 10 matters, not 10 commands, because it's actually 14 commands, these 10 matters, and they were written on the two tablets of stone. And myself, he commanded at that time, God commanded at that time, to teach you these statutes and these laws, that you should do them in the land, which you were crossing over to inherit. And the last verse that we're taking up is 15, where it says, Moses says to them, and you should guard yourselves exceedingly for your souls, for you did not see any form the day that God spoke to you from Horeb, from the midst of the fire. Now, just parenthetically, you should know, it says at least 8 times in this parsha that God spoke to the Jews from the midst of the fire. 2 of them are located right here in the verses we just read. And this is actually the first and the second time. And if you just want to jot down where the other times are, 4:33, 4:36, 5:4. Again, these are all the times where it says that God spoke to you from the midst of the fire. 5:19, 5:21, 5:23, numerous times. Okay. All right, so the questions we had about this, these series of verses, is what are the fundamentals, and how do we determine what is most primary about what Moses is telling the people here? Okay, so those are the questions I had posed to you. Now I'm going to leave, I'm going to open it up to you now. Okay, Helen, Esther, why don't you since you were resolved, I see that you can finally hear us now, what was the issue? This way educate us, this way we can instruct others if they had the same problem that you had. So just jot down on screen what you finally did that helped you get the sound. I appreciate that. And good to see my good friend Danny Gover. And Nissim joining us from San Diego. And J-A-C-J, Jack J. Hey Dan, how are you? Hope your summer's going good. And let me just wait a moment to see if Helen Esther had a problem with the sound, so we want to make sure I see what the resolve was. Okay, so Firefox, you couldn't do it. All right, thanks, Helen. Okay, so now let me open up the, since you all had the question, hopefully. So tell me what you think. Draw it on the screen. I'll pause now and wait for you to enter what you think the fundamentals are. Again, it's Deuteronomy 4:9 through 15. Chapter 4, verses 9 through 15. Tell me what you feel are the most fundamental concepts here, or what the fundamental concepts are, and explain to me how you determined that they were so fundamental. Okay, the sound is good for everybody? Question. At the end, so you just remind me. One more very interesting thing which actually happens in the beginning of the parsha. Like at any point, if you're ready for me to share with you what I was thinking on this, let me know. I'm just waiting for you at this point to see what you're jotting down on the screen, if you have a possible answer to the questions. Okay, let me put it this way. If you don't have an answer, just type no answer. This way I'll know to go ahead and give you mine. If you do have an answer and you're writing it down, just type answer and I'll wait. Okay. All right, so Dan, you're saying it seems as there is a stress on the method of revelation. And what is that method? And when you say stress, explain that to them. You're writing that the verses are not just saying to remember the fact that God revealed himself. But what are they saying? What is the addition? Adding, it says, but to remember the orchestration of events, the way in which God revealed himself, meaning a voice amidst the fire, no physical form. Okay, agreed. That's definitely good. And Helen is adding what your eyes have seen. Good. Those are two vital points. One is that God is saying to remember not just that it revealed himself, but that it was a voice amidst the fire, right? So why that form? And Helen, you're saying what your eyes are saying, right? But just to add, Dan, when you say stress, what you mean to say is that it's repeated. The fact that, as I mentioned, that it says it at least two times right here in these few verses, that God, that Moses, reminds the people that what they witnessed was a voice coming from fire, and they saw no form. Okay, so this was something like Helen, you're saying that they you witnessed this. Like Moses is not telling them to follow Judaism like the other religionists say to follow Christianity and Islam, which is purely based on belief, but Moses is saying, don't forget what your eyes saw. I mean, use the exact method by which you prove anything historically is true. Okay. So that's what the eyes seeing it has to do, and not to forget it. Because again, there will be a tendency to forget. That's why Moses tells them not to forget. He also says, and guard your souls exceedingly, twice. See, that's where the stress comes in. Just like where with Danny, I think you were getting at, was that it's stressing by doing, stress means that there's an emphasis. Emphasis means that it's either strong language or it's repeated. Here it's both. Here, you couldn't have a stronger language than saying that you should guard your souls exceedingly. right? It says, however, in 4:9, you should guard your souls exceedingly. And again, in 15, and you should guard your souls exceedingly, twice. So it's a very hard language, and it's repeated. And the reason for this is because this is really where the proof will be, that you have a system which is from God, that's divine. But it's a matter of life and death. This is another point. When Moses says that you have to guard your souls exceedingly, that means if you do not, then your life is really a waste. This is really how you're guarding your life. This is how you are ensuring that your life actualizes its purpose. That's why he says twice that you should guard your souls exceedingly. This is all about your existence. And if you deviate, and if you do not take to heart the great import of these words, the fundamentals that are here, so then you're missing the ikkar, the whole essence, that the system that we have is divine, that our existence is due to a creator, that he has providence, that he is relating to us at this moment. So there are tremendous fundamentals here. Okay. And this, of course, has to be something which is passed down. That's why he says at the end of 9, you should make them known to your children. And this is something which will be a proof even for people who were not there. But you're making it known to them. It's da'as. You see that? The end of 9. God is saying make it known to them. Inform them in an intelligent manner. And remind them of the day that you stood by Sinai, by Horeb. And all the people there, the ingredient is right there, as Rabbi Chait explained, that stress where it says, Hakel li asam, assemble for me the people. So in the Torah itself, Moses is repeating over to the Jews, reminding them that God said, assemble for me the people. So a multitude of about 2.5 million people were at that event. And that is something which they accepted, and they passed down the Torah that we have in our hands. So if we have this Torah in our hands, that is a confession that the people were assembled there. Now we have proof of the masses. This is not based on you look at Christianity and the other religions where, either in Christianity's case, the stories, the fables were written down 100, 200 years after the supposed events, because they couldn't have written them down at the moment. There was no moment. There was no event where Jesus fed 5,000 people with some fish and bread. Two fish or two loaves of bread and a fish, as they record. And the fact that they have four conflicting gospels should alert the reader that you do not have conflicting history. There's no conflict about who Caesar was, when he lived, of what country he was the emperor. There's only one story, because there were mass witnesses, and the information is simple. Those two ingredients, as Rabbi Chait explained, that is what you use to prove anything in history. You have masses that removes any type of subjective motivation, so there's no fabrication, and you also have no corruption in the story if the facts are very simple. Nobody ever thought that Kennedy was killed by hanging. It was a very simple phenomena to recall. A bullet had killed him. So when you have a very simple phenomena about a person's name and the country of Rome and the years that he lived, that's why there's no conflicting stories about Caesar or any other history, Alexander the Great, so on and so forth, Napoleon. The fact that you do have conflicting stories about Jesus shows you that it's complete lies. Here you have, again, a story which is no conflict, and it's actually accepted not only by the Jews, but by the major religions accept the events that are written in the Torah. Yeah, Dan, you have a question. Go ahead. If, again, anybody else has a question too, just alert me to it and type it on the screen. we'll get into the fire from the voice from the middle of the fire in one second. But think about that. Why is it that God constructed this event? Why is that the proof that the system of the Torah is divine? That a voice is emanating from fire and there's no physical form. What would you say about that? All right. So Dan is writing his question. Think about this question I'm posing to you now, which is the point that is repeated 8 times at least in this Torah section. Good question. So Danny is asking, at this point was Moses speaking to those who actually stood at Sinai? Well, it was only the men above 20 that died out in the desert for 40 years, correct? So anybody who was below was there. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, right? I think only the decree of the spies was on the men above 20. Okay, Nissim is saying that that is not a natural phenomenon. You're right, but the voice coming from fire, it's true, it's not natural, but neither was the Red Sea, parting, or the plagues. They were not natural phenomena either. There has to be something more than just natural here, in order to prove God's divine giving of the Torah. But Dan, correct me if I'm right, weren't they only above 20 that died out in the desert? Yeah, it would be good to have a source on that. But yeah, he has to be, if he's saying, don't forget what your eyes have seen, he must be addressing people that actually saw it. Certainly God's not going to kill out children who are below the age of responsibility. Okay, now Josh, very good Josh. So Josh is now answering, if you look on screen, he's answering the question as to why was this specific event? Okay, Dan, good. So now Josh is answering why this event was constructed, it was orchestrated as a voice emanating from fire. So he says that no creature could survive in fire. It could survive in air, earth, and water. Yes, but fire not. Exactly. So now that no creature can exist in fire, so now what does that tell us? Let's take it the next step, Josh. So the voice you're saying was not coming from a creature, right? So where was the voice coming from? Dan, I think the answer will be, first of all, in Numbers 14:31, where it says that your children that you said were going to be lost, I will bring them into the land. So evidently they have children at Sinai, and they will go into the land. So that means there was a living generation that was going to go into the land. And then we just got to see if there's a source that says that they were only above 20. You have to do a little research. All right. 1429, you're saying. Let's take a look. Oh, there it is, openly. Good. From 20 years old and up. Okay, so it's right there in Puzzle. Excellent. Okay. All right. Now, Josh, you're answering that. That proves it's supernatural. Exactly. I mean, the way that God proves that he is now given the Torah, and it's not something else, and it's divine, is that it has to be something which is intelligent and is not of this world. So anything of this world would not be able to survive fire. So that's why God used fire, and that's why it's repeated so many times, and it says you didn't see any form. Those are all crucial ingredients in order to drive the point home that you are hearing something intelligent, and that it's not biological, otherwise it would have died in fire, and it's not something which had any physical form whatsoever. So therefore it must be supernatural, it must be the Creator. Okay, and Helen is saying the same exact point. Very good. Okay. Right, so you see, the answers to the question, basically, are that this is a matter of life and death. So Moses repeats that twice. You should guard your souls exceedingly, because this is the whole point upon which your lives pivot. If you do not live based on the proof, so then we're not going to be any different than any other religion. It's just based on belief. And you see, this is exactly what Moses, the greatest of prophets, tells us. Don't forget what your eyes saw. Intelligent proof. And we mentioned this before, that Maimonides says in his letter to the people, to the letter of Marseille, to the village of Marseille, that there's only three reasons why a person should accept something as true. Either, number one, he experienced something, so he knows firsthand that something is true, an event took place. Number two, something which your mind tells you is true, like 2 + 2 = 4, you know for reasoning that it's true. And three, someone who is of great intelligence, who tells you something is true. Okay, but even there, though, a person has to prove it to themselves, as the duties of the heart says in the introduction. So that's the exact method that Moses is using here. Okay, and Josh, you're asking, isn't there a danger of ascribing location here? There is, and it's a good point, but there's also a good answer, because one of the commands that Moses gave to the people through God, and it was a second time given, was that God told Moses to rope off the mountain, that nobody could ascend the mountain once the horn is blasted. That means that there was a danger that they would look for something here, that they would ascribe some sort of location. Therefore, they were told not to ascend the mountain. And in the events that we have, like when the ark was brought back from the Philistines, so when it first came back to the first city, the Jews saw it coming back after it was gone for quite a while, and they were so excited, and they found that they got the ark, and it was on wagons being sent back, because God smote the Philistines with a number of plagues, and they just couldn't take it. So they captured the ark, and they initially put it into their it's a very interesting story. They initially put it into their temple in front of one of the gods called Dagon. So Dag in Hebrew means fish. So this god had the torso of a human, actually a torso of a fish, but the arms and the head of a human. And this is a very common type of practice where you take two typical creatures and you mix them in a certain form and you project certain new powers, and that's what they did in this case. So when they first brought the ark in to their god, so they came back the next morning and they saw that their god was fallen down in front of the ark. So they propped it up again, and the next day they came in, not only was the god fallen down again, but now it was the fish parts were separated from the human parts. Why? In order to try to educate the Philistines that what you are ascribing great powers to, because you think it's some sort of a new type of a entity, is nothing more than just a combination of things that you wouldn't bow down to. You wouldn't bow down to a fish, you wouldn't bow down to a man. So So now God was giving them an opportunity to see, hey, our God called Dagon, there's nothing more than some fish parts and some human parts. And if they would see that, their mind could hopefully latch onto that. So see how God works to educate. And but what happened was, getting back to your question, Josh, so when the ark finally was sent back from the Philistines, because they just couldn't take the constant plagues that God smote them with, so the Jews ran, they saw the ark, they opened up the ark, they looked inside, and guess what? God killed 57,000 people because they looked in the ark. God also killed the two sons of Aaron, who approached the Holy of Holies without being instructed to do so. The commonality between all these cases and the Jews ascending the mountain is that in any case where a person would assume that there's something regarding God that you can see, whether it's in the ark, in the Holy of Holies, or whether it's at the top of the mountain, if you have that notion, so then your existence is worthless, and a person would be killed. And that's why God killed 57,000 people. So we see that there was a danger of God creating an event at a certain location, but that's the concession that has to be made. I mean, the temple as well. You can say that, I mean, why does God create a voice that comes down from between the two cherubs? So if a person is using his mind, he will understand the ideas. So it's very important that the person does not go into the Holy of Holies. He's killed. You see what happened with the two sons of Aaron. And also that's why God told Moses at Sinai to rope off the mountain, not to allow the people any expression of a belief that there's something on this mountain about God, that God is taking up any location whatsoever. In my opinion, the reason why a mountain was used is just like you have the concept of a stage. A raised platform is necessary for masses to see something at a distance. And Dan, you're writing as follows. Another suggestion, perhaps that is why after the event at Sinai, they were allowed to ascend the mountain to demonstrate the location was just an accident of revelation, but not related to God anyway. That's a good point. Good point. There's really nothing permanent about this place. And you see also Moses' burial spot was obscured, because that would have been something that people might come to be too attached to. Same concept. So there is a need for man to have experience. Experience will mean location, Josh. So, I mean, I guess there's no way really around that. But that can be addressed in a certain way, where if people take care and God gives commands that will restrain any type of erroneous opinions from being formulated, then it will be safe. The event can take place, the necessary proof will exist and be proliferated throughout all the future generations. At the same time, they'll be reminded by Moses, remember and guard your souls exceedingly, he says twice, because you only heard a voice, intelligence, but there was no form whatsoever. There was nothing here. So that actually also combats the notion of location. You didn't see anything. Okay. All right. Any other questions? You see how much there is to glean from the words. I mean, King Solomon said this. He said, I believe it's 2:5 in Proverbs, where he says that because God gives forth knowledge. From his mouth comes wisdom and understanding. So what are the two parts of that verse? That God gives forth knowledge. He gives forth wisdom. And then it says, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. Meaning to say that God is the source of wisdom. That's the first part of the verse that King Solomon is saying. So therefore, we should have a great appreciation for what you're studying. But not only is God the source, but what does it mean his mouth gives forth knowledge and understanding? Mouth means the articulated word that you have in the Torah. So the actual formulations of these verses that we're reading have tremendous amount of wisdom. Rabbi Chaid said, he said, let the verses speak to you. That means if you're sensitive to the nuances and the words and you read through it slowly, you'll start seeing questions, but then those questions will give way to answers. Dan, you had a question. Go ahead. After this, I'll leave you with a question that we'll take up the next time, which will be, I think we should be going back this Sunday at 11:15 a.m. Okay, your question is, do you think there is any relationship between this voice amidst the fire and Moses' first prophecy by the burning bush? It's a good association. I never made that association before. That's very good. I like that. That is very good, Dan. Well, that's pretty sharp. You mean to say that the fire was it's a theme. It's not just a one-time event. I mean, the first time that Moses got prophecy, it was in the form of fire also. There it says that it was because the significance was that it was not being consumed, not because it was a voice. Let's see. Does it say the voice is coming from the snare? Was the voice coming from the bush? That is Exodus 4. Let's take a look. Chapter 3. Yeah, it does say from the midst. 3:4. Exodus 3:4. You're right. And God saw that he turned to see the bush. Right, because Moses first said, the verse says what? That Moses, right in the beginning of chapter 3 in Exodus, Moses was shepherding the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he was guiding the sheep through the desert, and it came to the mountain of God in Horeb, and there appeared an angel of God to him in a flaming in a flame from amidst a bush, and he saw. And behold, the bush was burning, but it was not being consumed. So Moses said, I will now turn aside to this great vision. Why is this bush not being consumed? And God saw that he turned aside to see. And they're called from the midst of the bush, God. And he spoke to Moses. Okay, so you're right. Right, so Josh is asking a good question. So, according to Maimonides, this was a vision. So that would remove your question, Dan. That would rule out this being a similar type of thing. There may be still some similarity in terms of flame, but Maimonides says in the guide that any time that it says an angel spoke or appeared, so you can know for surety that the entire account from beginning to end, even if the angel was only mentioned at the end, you should know for a surety that the entire account was a vision. But it's only if it says the angel spoke or appeared. Not if there was an angel. Because many times you have like the Malach of that went before the Jews when they were leaving Egypt. The pillar of fire or the pillar of cloud. So I believe there it says that God moved that Malach from in front of the Jews to behind them. But it doesn't say that that Malach spoke or that it appeared. It said that God moved it. In that case, it's physical. as like King David says, that God makes in Baruch Inafshi, in one of the Psalms, he says that God makes the winds and the fire his messengers. He makes his messengers as wind, as blowing wind, and those who minister him as flames. That means he uses the physical world as his agents. So that's a physical angel. But when it says an angel spoke or appeared, then Maimonides says that has to be in a vision. So if you want to think about that for Sunday, I'll leave you with that question. I'll leave you with one more question too. And that is the beginning of our parsha. It's a very odd sequence of this past week, Rosh Hashanah. After Moses asked God to go into land, God says, no, don't continue to speak to me about this matter anymore. So Moses then continues addressing the people, reminding them that at a certain point, this is 3:29 in Deuteronomy, 3:29. He says that we dwelt in a place called Gai, opposite Beis Peor. That was an idolatrous site. Peor was an idol. And Josh, yes, I would say that. Let me just see, it's a few questions on the screen. Let me address that before we go with this new question. Agreed, Dan. Yeah, the fire in relationship to God. But it wasn't for the sake of the fire by Moses. It wasn't a real fire, so there was not that element of something not being able to exist in a physical fire, since it wasn't physical. And Josh, you're mentioning what's the purpose of the darkness cloud and thick cloud? To obscure, yes. Actually, my mind, he says that in the Guide for the Perplexed, that he says that we have a tradition that the day of Sinai was cloudy and a little bit rainy. Meaning to say that whenever there is revelation, there's always cloud. You see that was constant by the temple, that the cloud always came down. And when the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, goes in one day a year in Yom Kippur, what does he do when he goes into the Holy of Holies? He has to first cloud up the room. Any time that there is a close, quote-unquote, approximation to God, where there's revelation, a high degree of revelation, there has to be cloud in order to tell man that this is not something which you can see. It's not part of the physical world. And remind yourself, it's not that the cloud is hiding God, you know, God forbid. It's that the cloud is to remind you that what you're now experiencing is not something which is viewable. And maybe even for another reason, to obscure any type of visual projection that a person might make. You see that people have the ability to think that they're seeing an oasis. And the whole thing, the whole concept of demons that the Talmud talks about. So it says that says one thing. It says don't give a hello. Don't give greetings to a demon. But it says, so that would seem to imply that demons are real. But the Talmud also says that demons are only found in four places: on mountaintops, in the desert, in a pit like a cave, or at nighttime. So what do you mean? The demon can't walk off of a mountain if it's a real thing? How come it can't get out of the cave? How come it's stuck in the middle of the desert? How come it's only around at nighttime and not during the day? So what the rabbis are telling you is that these four places have one common bond: a mountaintop, in the middle of the desert, in a cave, and nighttime are all situations of human isolation when you're alone. On top of a mountain, nobody else lives there. In the middle of the desert, in a cave, at nighttime, you can't see anybody. So in all those instances, what happens is, if a person is alone long enough, he will start desperately needing somebody to talk to. There was a film out once that had a guy that was a captive. He was not captive. He was a castaway. And after being alone for so long, he started talking to inanimate objects, because and that's why also solitary confinement is the worst punishment, because that is the strongest need that a person has, is to be social. And if you're not with somebody long enough, if you're in these isolated places, you will eventually start assuming that you see people, just because the psychological need for company is so strong. So therefore, the rabbi said, don't give greetings to a demon. A demon just means what you fabricate in your mind and you assume that you see. So they say, listen, this is going to happen. This will happen. You will think you're seeing somebody. But don't cross the line between fantasy and reality by giving greetings to it. That's where you now cross the line. So they're just advising a person that in this type of a psychological state of mind, just be on guard, and you will start perceiving things, just like you see an oasis. If you're away from water long enough, you're going to want it so much you'll see it. And if you're away from people long enough, you're going to start assuming, hey, that looks like a person up ahead, because you have the need. That's why we dream at night about things that we want so much. We can't satisfy ourselves during the day. That's what the dream does. It allows a certain outlet. The Talmud says that if a person if a person goes 7 days without an evil dream, so that person is wicked. And the reasoning is because since he doesn't have a need for an evil dream, that means he must be acting out all his evil desires when he's awake. It's the person who's controlling his desires that typically a week is not going to go by without some sort of a aggressive or an evilness or a lustful type of a dream, because there's regular needs. Okay. So, what we're saying over here. Now let's just go back. We were talking about the one more question I was going to give you. So you have one question so far. And the next question is, when it says that we dwelt in a place called Beis Peor, again, that's Deuteronomy 3:29. And then after that, it says, now Israel, listen to the statutes, the commands which I teach you today to do them. This is now the beginning of chapter 4 in Deuteronomy. So you should do the statutes and commands in order that you should live and you should come to the land and inherit it, which God had given to your forefathers. Don't add onto the Torah, don't subtract from it. Keep the mitzvahs of God. And then he goes back and he says in 4:3, your eyes have seen which God did to poor. All the men that went after this idol, God wiped them out. So what is Moses doing by breaking up this discussion about poor? He talks about that we dwelt by poor in 3:29. And then he starts talking about keeping the Torah and the statutes, not adding and not subtracting. Then he goes back and he says that all those who worship Baal were destroyed. So clearly there's a break. He starts with Peor, goes off the topic, leaves idolatry, talks about not adding, not subtracting to the Torah. Then he goes back and he reminds the Jews that whoever worshipped this Peor was killed. So that's the question I want to leave you with. What is this sequence? All right, everybody have the question. Good question, right? Okay, so I think we'll wrap it up here for now. We'll pick up Sunday at 11:15 New York time, and we'll take up these two questions. My pleasure, Dan. Where exactly is FH? Is that the Forest Hills, I would guess, or Fort Hamilton? Only ones that come to mind. Okay, so we'll pick up again Sunday, 11:15. I hope you enjoyed. If you missed any part of it, we'll put this online shortly so you can hear it in its entirety. And I look forward to learning with you all again then. All right, so have a very good night, everybody, and we'll see you on Sunday. Okay, my pleasure. Glad you enjoyed. Have a good night, everybody.